It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 581 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, we have a high-octane doubleheader, and it features the return of both Dennis Culver and Madeline Holly Rosing. It all begins with Dennis Culver from DC's Unstoppable Doom Patrol, and their debut issue is being released this week. It's described this way: they're saving the world by saving the monsters. We discuss who the various characters are, how the book came to be, and what we can expect from this miniseries in the future. Be sure to let your local comic shop know that you want to buy this book. Then everything wraps up with my interview with Madeline Holly Rosing, who has a Kickstarter underway for Boston Metaphysical Society Mystery at Pikes Peak No. 1 through 2 until Friday, March 31 at 2:10 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. It's described this way: fleeing arrest, the team arrives at Tesla's experimental station to face a dangerous turn in Caitlin's abilities and a murder plot. Madeline updates us on how her various projects are moving forward, who the characters are in this book, and what we can expect from her in the months ahead. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what they both have to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. Weird with a heart. The world's strangest superheroes are saving the world by saving the monsters. It's great to welcome back to the podcast Dennis Culver, a creator of such good things as Edison Rex and writer for Marvel and DC and many other good things. How you doing, Dennis?
Doing real good. How you doing, Wayne?
Good, good. It's good to talk with you. And we were talking about a little bit before we started record. I'm a huge fan of the Doom Patrol, and particularly I love the HBO Max series. I'm startled that it's already coming to an end. It's only half of a season left, and then that's it. And so I was really pleased to find out that you're bringing back the Doom Patrol in what's apparently a six-issue miniseries so far, Unstoppable Doom Patrol. So how did that come to be?
It's kind of a funny story. I was wrapping up Future State Gotham with DC, and I was talking to my editor, Ben Abernathy, and we were kind of just talking about what's next. And I had a few ideas. I had an idea for a Robot Man story that kind of ends up being issue 3. It was almost like a road trip story. And I wasn't really like thinking specifically about Doom Patrol as a whole, you know, because it's a huge pedigree with that title. And, I had also just, worked on Justice League Incarnate, and we'd rotated a lot of artists out of that, but Chris Burnham was one of the artists on that series. And, Ben knows that me and Burnham used to share a studio together with some other artists when Burnham still lived here in Los Angeles. And so Ben was like, well, you guys should work together. You already worked so well together on Justice League Incarnate. Like, you know, you guys should do a book. And I was like, that's a great idea. I love Burnham's art. It sounds really good. And through the course of that conversation, we were just kind of talking about DC in general. And I kind of got off, funnily, I was just kind of ranting about Doom Patrol, like saying, you know, Doom Patrol has a TV show. You know, it's this concept that should be its own kind of pillar of the DC universe, you know, like it should be its own, you know, like its own franchise, and like kind of going off on that. And Ben finally said, he's like, well, you and Burnham should do Doom Patrol. And I was like, you know what? That's a good idea. Let me text Burnham. And I texted Burnham, and he was like, hell yeah. Like he was on board immediately. So it was the kind of thing where DC wasn't looking actively for a Doom Patrol comic, and I wasn't actively pitching for it, but it was just kind of like organically through us talking, realizing that there was this space for Doom Patrol that needed to be filled. And then once that kind of got rolling, all kinds of cool things started happening. Part of the process to get it rolling was they wanted it to spin out of the Lazarus Planet crossover, which is, it's always a great way to launch a new series, is out of an existing crossover. Mm-hmm. And then the Dawn of DC initiative started coming together as Dark Crisis was wrapping up, and it was like we were in development and ready to go. And it was a real good boost for our book to be a part of that. And then through no fault of ours, we discovered that this year is also the 60th anniversary of Doom Patrol as well. So it's like all these neat little, the universe has conspired to kind of, make this book, coming out at just the right time. And I think that's really neat. While the Doom Patrol TV show is wrapping up, I think that allows us an opportunity to kind of, be there waiting for fans of that show to have something to kind of latch on to after they come off of that.
Boy, it's funny you say that, because that's exactly what I've got me feeling so good about this series. And I have to say, the characters, I heard the actors' voices when I listened to the characters speak in this book. You made a copy available, an earlier version for me to do it. And whenever Robot Man speaks, I hear the actor.
Yeah, it's real neat how that works. It's kind of like when Batman the Animated Series started happening and became, was everywhere. It was hard to ever read a Batman comic without hearing Kevin Conroy's voice. And I think when there's a really good version of something in other media, like it kind of moves into your imagination when you're reading the comics, and it's definitely a good thing. Like I'm happy that people will hear Brendan Fraser's voice when Robot Man speaks, and all the other great actors that were on that show.
It's really, really good thing, and I'm going to truly miss that show, because it was that weird business is so nice to have once in a while, because standard superhero stuff, believe me, I love my Long Johns guys, but I really like something very different, and this is very different, and this series just feels like it's a spinoff or following up exactly from Doom Patrol and HBO Max. So was that intentional? I mean, were you trying to get the same feel in the comic that we had on the show?
Well, I'm a lifelong fan of Doom Patrol as a comic. When I was in high school, I was reading the Grant Morrison, Richard Case Doom Patrol series, and then I kind of started, digging up the issues that happened before, and then like anytime there was a new Doom Patrol book, I would follow it. And I think the TV show does a really good job of synthesizing all the previous versions of Doom Patrol and putting that kind of heart and soul into the show. So, the comics, I reread all of the comics in advance of it. I've watched the show every episode at least a couple times. So there's like an Ouroboros of influence that's kind of informs all of that. The comics inform mm-hmm. The show is now kind of informing the comics. And it's continuing that. I definitely wanted it to have that kind of feeling from the show and all the previous runs. I wanted it to feel very accessible to all fans of Doom Patrol, while at the same time, if you've never read Doom Patrol, you can pick this comic up and you're not lost. You know what's going on. Like it smells like the TV show. It feels like the comics, but you can jump right in, with both feet, and we're not going to let you drown.
It's really, really great. I really enjoyed it. The there are some things that are different. I liked somebody referred to this as a superhuman first responder group of the DC universe. Do you want to talk a little bit about what that whole business is about? Because this is not your general superhero group. They have a very specific purpose. What purpose is that?
Yeah, well, part of like rereading all of the Doom Patrol and kind of thinking about it, I'm a big fan of all your comics count, right? And so I like the idea of like, well, if this is the Doom Patrol is this team that has had every issue of the comic, every iteration of the comic happen to them in one way, shape, or form. It's not perfect, but that's a part of their history, right? And if you kind of look at where they started, you know, in the Arnold Drake and Bruno Premiani comics versus, you know, going through the Kupperberg and Grant Morrison comics. And then, you know, the last one was with Gerard Way and Nick Darrington. You can kind of see this arc of these characters that were dealing with their trauma and definitely on the path of kind of healing their trauma and processing it. And I think when you get to the end of the Gerard Way run, they're, you know, some of them are more healed than others, but they're on a journey for that. And I think that when you start kind of getting your stuff together and fixing it, there's this natural impulse to want to help other people. And so that's kind of the mindset that I came into our new pitch with that. And I latched onto this tagline that I use called, and it, you know, their main mission statement, which is saving the world by saving the monsters. And it's this interesting idea coming out of the Lazarus Planet crossover, which was this event where this volcano that was over Lazarus Pit exploded, and it caused this like magical weird rain to like storm all over the earth. And you know, people were magically changed into monsters. Some like developed new superpowers, all kinds of crazy stuff happened. So through the course of that, we discovered that there's more metahumans on the planet than ever. Like in the DC universe, there's some people have a metagene, and it's usually when there's an accident happens, it causes you to your powers to activate, usually in response to that trauma or that accident, which is kind of a perfect thing for Doom Patrol. So now there's all these, there's more metahumans than ever. And if you kind of logic that out, if you look at the climate of the fictional world of DC, if you suddenly, something like that happened to you and you developed powers, you're not necessarily going to become a very handsome or beautiful superhero or even a supervillain. Sometimes you're just a monster and that has to be dealt with, right? And really the best case scenario, which isn't always great, is you get sent off to Star Labs. We've seen that happen 100 times in comics. Like somebody gets out of control and they get sent to Star Labs. It's still a laboratory. You're still being poked and prodded. It's not a comfortable way to deal with these new abilities. But that's the best option. And then there's worse options as you go from there. Like, you know, you get sent to some kind of prison. Like, you know, you get sent to Arkham Tower, which isn't great. Usually anybody that goes to Arkham, they either become, you know, a worse villain, or they become a victim of one of those villains that are there. And then I think the absolute worst thing that can happen in the DC universe, if something happens to you, is you get sent someplace like the Suicide Squad, where they put a bomb in your head and you're literally a living weapon for the government. Mm-hmm. It's not great. And so the Doom Patrol is this team of metahumans, is this team of monsters. You know, they're not your typical pretty, sexy superheroes. You know, they look like classic monsters almost. They're looking at this and they've decided, even in the last book, they were riding around in an ambulance, then it's like they've become this metahuman rescue team. And so that's why we've changed their color from the traditional red of superheroes to orange. So I want them to look like emergency responders. So they show up when something happens, and there's a new metahuman. Their focus is there. They're not trying to stop them necessarily. They're trying to help them. And then they have a new base called the Shelter, where they take these metahumans, and they're not teaching them to become soldiers in a war. They're teaching them to learn to live with these abilities. Because if, you know, suddenly you have tentacles for arms, you got to really, that's not just a fun power. You've got to like figure out how to tie your shoes and brush your teeth and really figure out all those things. So that's what they do at the Shelter. And then like we have Flex Mentallo, who's a former Doom Patrol member. He's still on staff. He's kind of like the physical therapist of the team. So he's teaching all these new metahumans to kind of use their physical bodies to live with their powers. And, you know, some of them might become superheroes, some of them might become supervillains, but a lot of them are just going to go and live a life. And I think that's something that's not really been done a lot in superhero comics.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting how you're kind of blending all the different versions of Doom Patrol together in this. And, you know, it drives me nuts when sometimes you'll have a version of a group and then the next version comes along and doesn't even resemble the one that we had before. So I appreciate you being able to bring all these elements together into a cohesive whole. Boy, that's refreshing, I have to say.
Yeah. All your comics should count. Like like everything that happened. Even the stuff you don't like happened. And it's, we just keep going forward from there. You know, like I've been a comic reader since I was 4 years old, and you know, it's the one thing that I've liked, you know, like, especially like following comics like X-Men, it was just this long history of things that happened. And that's kind of interesting. And it's fun to know that when you read an old comic that it mattered and it was part of what you're reading now.
Yeah. The first thing I ever read in my life was a Batman comic.
Oh, cool. Me too.
Yep, I remember when, and Frank Miller said when he read a Batman comic, he opened up the book and he fell in.
Yeah.
That was my experience. I suddenly was, I'll never forget it. Batman was over in England and he had put this like a glider thing on his back and he's flying around this castle so he can patrol it and in England and he's doing his stuff. And I was there. I was standing there watching him fly around and Batman to this day is still my guy. And so I'm always getting a kick out of those
guys. Yeah. I don't know if you have seen the pictures online of SeaWorld used to do this water skiing show with superheroes. Mm-hmm. And I'm from Florida originally. And so we went there when I was a kid and watched that water skiing show. It's when I'm 4 years old. And when you come out of the show, there were people dressed up as superheroes handing out free comics from DC. And so the first comic I was ever handed was an issue of Batman. It was like him and Catwoman getting up to some business. Like, so it's, I was like indoctrinated at a really early age. And of course I was a fan of all like the cartoons and TV shows and movies that were around back then. I think there's something really special and unique about comics that hit a really sweet spot with our imagination.
Now I've got to ask, because this is sort of a Marvel way of doing things. It's called the Unstoppable Doom Patrol, and I understand you had something to do with that. Unstoppable is not the adjective I would come up with. I would think of like unusual or unique or something.
Yeah, well,
like
I wanted it to kind of be behind their mission, which is this idea that, you know, they're going forward. They're saving the world by saving the monsters. They're not letting anyone get in their way. In the first issue, they go to Gotham City, and they go there without Batman's permission. They just go because there's a metahuman in need. And, you know, that causes problems. Obviously, Batman doesn't like people just showing up in his city and doing superhero stuff. So it's kind of, that is a part of the aggressive, proactive mindset that this team has. They're unstoppable. This is it's an unstoppable force of nature. They're coming. They're going to do this whether you like it or not. They're not worried about stepping on the toes of other superheroes or the government or anything like that, which, you know, causes some problems too.
Well, that's good. It shouldn't always be that everything is, whenever superheroes are involved, it's all clean and easy.
Right.
I like that about that. Now, why don't we talk about who appears in the first issue? Because there's some really interesting stuff going on, and I don't want to spoil stuff. So I'm going to kind of depend on you to talk about what we should say and what we shouldn't. Of course, obviously, you can't have the Doom Patrol without the main three. Robot Man is there, and Larry Trainer is there, Negative Man, and Elastigirl.
We're calling her Elastawoman now, but yeah, she's in there too. Yeah, you got to have the core three there. As I was putting the team together, I was really thinking about, you know, like the TV show does a real good job of having like those iconic three characters there, you know, plus the Chief. Given the team's history, like, you know, or even with the TV show, the Chief is the one who kind of caused the accidents of those characters that led to their condition. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really, you know, given everything that's happened in the comics, I didn't think it was, it felt true to have the Chief back in a leadership role with that team. But I still wanted there to be a definitive leader. And so I took Crazy Jane, who has like 64 different personalities, and all those personalities have a superpower. We haven't met all of them, so that's kind of an open canvas. And I thought, well, what if one of those personalities is the new chief of the Doom Patrol? So Jane has a new alter called the Chief, and she wears an orange mask on her face, which is kind of evocative of the Chief's beard. And she's leading the team now. And if you read the old series, the Gerard Way series, it was kind of, Jane was kind of stepping into a leadership role. So this is, you know, kind of the natural progression of that. I also, you know, as a fan when Beast Boy was a member of the team, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, before Beast Boy was in the Titans, he was a part of the Doom Patrol. Right. And I like, you know, it's always cool when you have the plucky kid, you know, running around with the team. It's kind of, it's great to have that kind of character, that archetype. And I was like, well, what if it was Beast Girl? You know, and it's a similar type character, but not the same. She's not a shapeshifter. Her powers are more affecting like the lizard brain of people, like their fight or flight responses. Basically she can make you super scared of her, but also she's adorable. So it's an interesting contrast there. And it's Burnham's absolute favorite character to draw. I think everybody's going to love this character. Everybody's going to be blown away by her. And so then that kind of gave us like the core, you know, all the archetypes of the team fulfilled. They look, if you squint at it, it kind of looks like the original, but it's a little different. I needed a character that was kind of the counterpoint to this, you know, the character who's going to call them out on their BS, if the mission, you know, to kind of question the mission and kind of be that voice for the reader. And that's how we ended up developing this character, Degenerate. And Degenerate is, his powers actually work, it's not from anger. It's from him being mean. It's from him making a choice, to be a jerk. And that's what actually, you know, gives him power. And the meaner he is, the more he kind of devolves and he gets stronger and bigger. But if that goes on for too long, it can get to the point where he's out of control. So he's kind of walking that line. But it's interesting to have a character running around who is consciously being a jerk, like being an asshole is his personality, and we've all known people like that. So it's like having that guy kind of do that, and you know, it's like, you know, it's natural to want to see that guy soften up, but if he softens up, it literally makes him weaker. So it really plays well with the dynamic.
I like the title of the first issue is Degenerates One and All.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Without getting too much into the issue, but yeah, they end up going to Gotham, and you know, it's on a mission, to save a metahuman. And then it all goes way out of control and way unexpected. Batman shows up and they have a big disagreement with Batman. By the time this podcast comes out, people will know that, the government is after Doom Patrol, and one of the people working with the government to chase them down is Peacemaker. Because we're going to be showing some art from issue 2 at the WonderCon panel on Friday, and Peacemaker's clearly in that. So, he's another character that's going to be a recurring character in the book, kind of the, representing, you know, that Suicide Squad angle that I talked about earlier. And he's the kind of the counterbalance to the Doom Patrol, and he's after them. But yeah, I know you took a look at it. The book looks great. It's Chris Burnham on art and then Brian Reber on colors. This is the first time they've worked together, and I think they're a dream team. Like, it looks so good.
It's terrific. I mean, it's a perfect marriage of your script and that art. Just go. I get back to talking about your script, because there are some wonderful, you know, one of the things I always enjoy about your writing is the ability to, let's say, have an important sentence that moves the story along and also sets the tone. And we get that right on the very first page.
Those pages are, those preview pages are out. Yeah, we some of the classic villains are a part of the book. Munster Mala and the Brain are kind of right there on the front. I've given the Brain, he's upgraded himself, so he's got a gorilla body to match Mala's. And they're fighting some of General Immortus's cult who've all kind of like zombied out. So it's a real great image for a first page of a comic.
And then, of course, the brain says, prepare yourself, Mala. He says, things are about to get weird.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a perfect start for the for the very first page. And then, of course, we get to the inside, the pages 2 and 3. Robot Man's driving the bus, which, of course, we've seen on the show and stuff like that as well. You can see them go past the Gotham City Limit sign. And Robot Man says to himself, I hate this town.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's no one's happy. No one's happy to be in Gotham. Batman's not happy they're in Gotham. I love the way Burnham and Reber made Gotham look. Like, it really looks like this, like, dirty, gross city. You know, it's like, it looks like the way, you know, like New York in the 70s or something. Like, it has that mm-hmm. kind of smoggy skies and everything. I think it really feels like how Gotham should feel, like almost oppressive.
Well, then the worst part is Robot Man parks the bus right in the middle of the street.
Right, right, right. Yeah. And normally the bus isn't their normal mode of transportation, but they're trying to, you know, be a little incognito rolling into town, but it doesn't exactly go to plan.
No. And then, of course, and I'm not going to spoil them, there are some amazing surprises along the way. And I would never in any way even begin to spoil them. But just when you think you know what's going on, it's not. That's not what's happening. And there's some absolutely wonderful stuff that is happening when at the very beginning. And sometimes it involves the villains, and sometimes it involves the heroes. And God, I there's nothing in this world I love more than being surprised. And boy, you do a wonderful job of tremendous surprises along the way. And
I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm really excited for people to read the book and really excited to see their reaction to it, because it's, you know, I feel like because we're part of the Donna DC initiative, this is the first time in a while that a Doom Patrol book has really been firmly grounded in the DC universe. And so you kind of walk a fine line where you do the traditional weirdness of what you expect from a Doom Patrol comic, but also I want it to feel like it's a part of the DC universe and not just over off in its own corner. So there's a lot of things we're doing to make sure that it does feel grounded in a part of that. Like in issue 3, a couple of the Doom Patrol members square off against Hal Jordan Guy Gardner and Kyle Rayner. So it's the Green Lanterns are chasing them across country as like Cliff and Larry are driving, trying to get this metahuman to safety. So that's a real fun issue too. It's going to be a real good time. I think what's interesting about having the Doom Patrol firmly planted in the DC universe is there's a lot of material that feels new. Like, even to the Doom Patrol interacting with Green Lanterns isn't something that's really happened in any kind of significant way. Right. And that's kind of neat, you know, and it's really fun making them a part of this universe. And you know, my ultimate goal is to have this be, you know, its own strong franchise where it's like, you know, the Doom Patrol are, you know, much like the Avengers and the Fantastic Four and the X-Men are kind of their own little families of books over there. I would love to have the Doom Patrol be that same kind of thing here in the DC universe with other books like the Justice League.
Well, this first issue is a very strong move in that direction. And I have to say, I have to say, and I'm not going to spoil it, but Robot Man kind of resolves the important situation, but he doesn't do it in a way I expect. In fact, I'm actually quite proud of him.
Yeah.
When he does that, he doesn't, like I said, that was a surprise to me, and I'm never going to in any way spoil it, but sure. It was so well done. I just sat there and went, that is so cool for him. It was not what I ever dreamed he would do, but it was a wonderful way to resolve the situation.
Yeah. It's great giving them a new mission statement, because it really does change the frame of reference of what you get from a traditional superhero comic. Cause I think a lot of times, you know, the monster appears on page 3 and they're punching him on page 4. Right. And, you know, while we definitely have action, it's, you know, figuring out how to solve these problems when you're trying to save the monster, not just fight the monster. I think it makes a big difference.
It really does. It really, but what a totally different perspective on that, and something I really like about it. And there is a huge surprise at the end that I cannot in any way ever spoil, because wow, I want so badly to spoil it, but I just can't. It was just a wonderful shock, shall we say.
Yeah.
And so I love to be surprised, as I said. There is nothing better in this whole world than to read a book and turn the page and go, oh, and that's what I did at the end of this book. There is a massive surprise at the
awesome.
End.
Awesome. Well, you're going to love issue two, too. Like, and I mean, like, there's the neat thing about our book, too, because it's a miniseries, a lot of times when a miniseries happens, you expect it to be just this one continuous story, but because I want this to feel big and I want it to feel like we're building out something like a, you know, like a franchise. There are the first four issues are done in one issues where they're, you know, it's just an episodic issue. There's an underlying plot that kind of carries. And then the final two issues, issues five and six. Oh yeah. So the first four issues are done in one, and then five and six are a two-part story. So that it kind of like, by the time you get through the series, it feels like it's more comic than just six issues, because we have so many different stories going on. And, you know, usually when you read a comic, the first six issues are all in a trade and that's just one story. There's a lot of bang for your buck with this series. And I think that's pretty cool.
Well, that first issue is amazing, I have to say. Just so much fun to read and so amazing. One of the things I really enjoyed, and I don't know if this was you that came up with this or Chris did this, whenever they're holding these Immortus acolytes, they're always holding them upside down.
Yeah, I mean, that's just Burnham. Burnham loves, like, you know, I just give, like, I point Burnham in the right direction, and, like, he comes up with all the cool little bits of business and stuff. Like, even when, you know, the other characters are running around, if you like, there's the characters that are talking, but if you look at the characters in the background and kind of pay attention to what Burnham has them doing, he's always got, no one's ever just standing around. They're always acting and doing things. And it's like, it makes it real fun when you go back over the comic and kind of pour over the art all over again.
It was great to also see him draw Batman again.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, that's always great. Like he was so good on Batman Incorporated. So, excuse me. Yeah. Having the opportunity to come back and do that is really cool. And we get Robin in there too. Tim Drake. He's running around in the background for the most part, but it was nice to get Batman and Robin on screen.
Well, you can't get to Gotham. Somehow they're omnipresent when it comes to Gotham.
For sure. If it's not them, you're going to run into one of their buddies.
That's right. So one of the Bat families somewhere hanging around and stuff. But it is such a wonderful book, full of surprises, full of shocks, and full of amazing humor, and so good. I just it makes me pine for this to be a monthly series. I know that may not be possible right off with the Chris schedule, but God, so good.
Said, the plan is to do a 6-issue series each year. There's always potential to have, you know, specials and have us participate in crossovers and things like that as well. But really, it starts with letting your comic shop know that you want this book, you know, putting it on your pull list so that, you know, your retailer knows that every issue is something they can count on you buying. And that sends a message to DC that there's support for this book. And it's, you know, we have to build it issue by issue. But if people show up for it, DC is more than happy to do more. Like we've been talking internally about it. It's just all really depending on, you know, the readers showing up for the book.
Well, you know, as a big Bat fan, you know, the last year or two have been, you know, they could have called DC Batman Incorporated for all, because almost every book had something to do with Batman or a Batman family member in it and stuff. And unfortunately, I just heard that they canceled Batgirls and the Tim Drake book. So,
I mean, that's kind of, if you look at a lot of comics tend to wrap up around issue 12 or issue 18, because they go in like 6-issue chunks, but, I think there's, you know, Batman's really popular. And I think the cool thing about this Dawn of DC initiative is part of that, is kind of DC wanting to expand the line beyond all the Batman stuff. And I think a lot of that Batman heavy things kind of happened during the pandemic, you know, like it was the reliable comic that everybody showed up for. And, you know, I think there's some really cool and exciting stuff coming up. When I look at the previews catalog and the solicits with all this Dawn of DC stuff, you know, there's a lot of really cool variety. I'm super excited. There's a bunch of books that I can't wait to read. Josh Williamson's doing a great job on Superman. I'm looking forward to Jeremy's take on Green Lantern and Tom's take on Wonder Woman. Like, there's going to be some fun stuff.
Well, the great thing is that this book is one of the early ones for the Dawn of DC, and it has a logo, what I can tell, on the cover. And so it's a great way to kick off that whole event, or do that, because this is a strong, strong title. And then right away you get drawn into the story. Like I said, there's action, there's also humor, there's all kinds of things. And I have always been interested in Doom Patrol, and you know, my brother always used to say that Doom Patrol, if there had been comic shops when the Doom Patrol comic first came out, Doom Patrol would still be an ongoing book today, because it was so popular. It was big among fans, but it didn't necessarily sell to the whole public as well. But see, I think that this is the ideal time to put this book out. I really do. I think that this is going to be a big hit, and I think people are going to really enjoy it, because it's true to the show. It's true to the comics. It's just an ideal marriage of all of this Doom Patrol history pulled together. And I'm expecting good things when numbers start coming in, because
yeah, boy, I'm really hopeful about it too. Like, we have a real strong vision for the series, just like the characters have a strong mission statement, but we're also, you know, we're being aggressive about what we want to accomplish. And, you know, like, we've got lofty aspirations, but I think that, you know, if we do our job right, people will show up.
Well, I agree with that. I think it's a good time to do it right now, because I'm grieving for the loss of Doom Patrol on HBO Max, and this is going to help soften the blow for me. I'm going to be able to read this wonderful Doom Patrol, which is it's just one of the best Doom Patrols I've read, and I've read a lot of Doom Patrol.
I really appreciate that. That means a lot, Wayne. Thank you.
It's just going to work, I think, so well. Gosh, I would love to see this be an animated series. Get Mr. Gunn involved. Say, hey, Mr. Gunn, over here, read this book here, will you?
And hopefully he'll like us having Peacemaker in there. That wasn't our intention. When we were putting Peacemaker in it, we didn't know that he was taking over all the film stuff, but it just kind of is a happy accident. Kind of like everything else with this book. So, you know, like I said, it's a 60th anniversary. It's a good time to be a Doom Patrol fan. Like, I think I'm, you know, this is the comic that I would want to read if I was a reader reading a Doom Patrol book. So it's the best I can do as a lifelong Doom Patrol fan.
Well, you did a great job, I have to say. I really loved it, and I'm excited to read future issues, because, boy, I can't wait to see what else you've got in store for us as fans and stuff. We could think it's going to be great. Are there other projects you're working on that we should be aware of, or are these guys keeping you busy?
DC's keeping me busy right now. I've always poking away at some creator owned stuff. Nothing I can talk about right now. But yeah, there's the Night Terrors crossover that's been announced with DC. I'm doing something for that that hasn't been announced yet, but, I think people will be real happy about that as well. But yeah, we've got some cool stuff coming up, on the DC end of things. And then, should have some, more announcements soon.
Well, that's good. I always like it when somebody says, I got things going, but I can't say anything about it. That's a good sign, because
It's always, I mean, there's always things cooking. Sometimes it just comes down to, like, you know, time and everything else. I also have for the company Webtoon, which is an app. We have a comic that comes out every week that's been going for, I think, 24 weeks now, if I'm not mistaken, maybe a little longer, but, yeah, if you're a fan of that kind of style of comics, you can look it up. It's called Gates of Hell.
What's it about?
Well, it's about this girl named Jennifer, and She's a teenage girl. Her mother recently passed in a car accident. And when she's going through her mom's stuff, she finds this book that looks like a spell book, but it's got weird writing on it. And suddenly one of the spells reveals itself to her, allowing her to make a window into the afterlife. And in order to do that, she has to make a small animal sacrifice and rub its blood on a mirror. And she's trying to get a hold of her mom. She thinks maybe she can talk to her mom one last time and say all the things she didn't get to say. But instead, on the other side, there's a very handsome devil prince. And she sort of develops this long distance relationship with this devil prince. And then it just it gets kind of brutal from there. And it gets, the opening sentence of that book is "The road to hell is paved with good intentions." And it's kind of like it's almost like Buffy meets Breaking Bad in its own way.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. That's an interesting grouping on that.
Yeah, it's real fun.
Fun to do. Any chance that Mr. Edison Rex might make an appearance someday?
We have a plan for it. It was during the pandemic, actually, we got real close to negotiating an animation option for it, but it fell through. There's definitely Chris and I have mapped out a plan to finish the series. I don't know if I would have time to draw it, but it's something we would probably co-write together at the very least and make sure it got out there. But it's just, finding the time for it, and the when the audience is ready. I know how it ends. I would love to. We've got at least another 6 to 12 issues that would kind of wrap everything up. And hopefully we'll get back to it one day. But right now, no immediate plans.
If somebody wants to access that book, is it available somewhere? Because it used to be on, I think it was monkeybraincomics.com.
Yep.
Is there some way that people can access it? Did somebody make a print version?
Yeah, there's two collections. You can find them on Amazon. IDW published both of those. The third volume never got a chance to be collected, but you can still find it on Comixology and Kindle. Like the individual issues. I think they even sell a collection there, if I'm not mistaken.
Do you want to real quickly say what that book was about?
Edison Rex is it's basically an analog of Lex Luthor. It's the world's greatest criminal mind of his world. He finally does the impossible, and he kills his arch nemesis, who's called Valiant, who's like a Superman analog. And when that character dies, he challenges Edison Rex to put his money where his mouth was. And basically it's like, you've thought all this time you were better than me. And if I wasn't here, you would do such a better job. So why don't you? And so Edison Rex realizes he has to step up and do just that. So it's about this supervillain deciding to become a superhero and save the world. And it causes problems because, all the superheroes have known that he was a villain all this time. Also, there's the mystery of what happened to Valiant. And then we kind of go from there. Some real neat tricks we did, like all of the superheroes have names of comics imprints or publishers. So like the main guy being called Valiant, the Batman analog's called The Eclipse, the Wonder Woman analog's called Mirage. Like it's, if you're nerdy about comics in general, that you'll get a lot of little cool Easter eggs there. It was fun taking those characters and making their analog versions and then figuring out what their villains would be of those analog versions. And it's like some of them, you'd really have to squint to kind of figure it out, but it's there. But like our Bizarro version of Valiant is called Defiant, which is a very deep cut for, people that have been around while reading comics. But yeah, it's a super fun book. I drew it. It pretty much, that process, I ended up co-writing it with Chris. Chris Robertson is a generous collaborator. And through that process, I kind of discovered that I wanted to write. And, working with him really, helped me kind of solidify like, oh, I can do this. My ideas are working, and seeing him kind of like take an idea that I had and then like put it to script, that I later drew was like really gave me more confidence in putting my own ideas out there.
Well, let me tell you, I'm glad you went through that because it's working really well for Doom Patrol.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Great, great, great stuff to go on. If people want to follow you on social media, how do they do that?
I'm Dennis Culver everywhere, all one word, so I'm super easy to find. If you Google Dennis Culver, I'm the first result. You'll get all my stuff. So I won the Google battle, and I'm the top Dennis Culver.
Yeah, you're lucky. My name is Wayne Hall, and there are 20,000 of them out there.
Oh, man, that's a tough one. When I was younger, there was another Dennis Culver who was also an artist, and it was an older guy who did, like, Southwestern art, and he was always the top Google guy, and then, you know, he was just, like I said, he was older, he eventually passed on, and as, you know, I started doing a lot more work, so I slowly won. I'm sure there's another Dennis Culver out there waiting for me to get old enough to pass on.
Okay, well, it's great to talk with you again, Dennis. And man, you're doing such wonderful stuff. Again, it's Unstoppable Doom Patrol. Let your shop know you want it when it comes out this week.
Put it on your number list.
It's going to be monthly.
Yes. There'll be a small break. During the Night Terrors crossover, which we kind of had pre-planned to give Burnham a little space, but we'll talk about that more once that gets announced.
Okay, Dennis, well, it's wonderful stuff. I can say from reading the first issue, I highly recommend it, and I'm just looking forward to more good things from you, and just keep it all up, and hopefully we'll get to talk with you again sometime soon when other projects are coming out.
Cool. Thanks so much for having me, Wayne. I really appreciate it.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's great to welcome back to the podcast Madeline Holly Rosing from the ever-successful Boston Metaphysical Society. Is it a franchise? Are you a franchise now, Madeline? How's that work?
I don't know if we quite call it a franchise or is a long-running series.
Okay, well, whatever works. It's Boston Metaphysical Society. And you have a Kickstarter going on right now for, Mystery at Pike's Peak Issues 1 and 2, looks like. And everybody always wants me to get this out early as possible in there. This comes to a conclusion on the 31st, right?
Yes, at around 11 o'clock in the morning, Pacific Standard Time.
Okay, so that'll be good. Now, I love the description of it. Airships, ghosts, and murder. That's a great mix for a good story like that. And you have a release that came out instead. It talks about a couple of interesting things I thought were fun. Both issues 1 and 2, are going to be 32 pages, with story being 26 to 27 pages, with bonus content. And yes. So all kinds of good stuff going on with that. Before we dive into all that, why don't you, for anybody who may not have heard your previous interview with me, why don't you talk about what Boston Metaphysical Society is all about?
Sure. The original premise is about an ex-Pinkerton detective, a spirit photographer, and a genius scientist who battles supernatural forces in late 1800s Boston. We started with a 6-issue miniseries that then went to trade. That's what I call Volume 1, and that's with art by Emily Hugh. After that, we did 4 standalone sequels with art by Gwen Tavares. And then I decided to go back to the miniseries model for this particular story. And so Mystery at Pike's Peak is 4 issues long, and the Kickstarter is to print issues 1 and 2. Issue 1 is completely done, and issue 2 is currently being worked on by my artist, Elizabeth McKedza. And in fact, I have a whole new team on board for this series. Like I mentioned her name, the interior art is being done by Elizabeth McKedza, coloring by Katie Brown, and the main cover art is done by Angela Wu. And for the first time ever, we have two variant covers for one and two. The first one being done by Rio Burton, and for issue number two, we have one done by Steph C.
Wow. Okay, so all kinds of good things going on with that. We should mention, we're recording this a little early, as we always do. And as we're talking, you are right on the precipice of 600 backers. And yes. You are more than double your goal, so congratulations are due.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. A lot of hard work, and of course, a big thank you to the backers who believe in the project. I really appreciate it.
And that includes me. I'm backing. Since I have a stack of books as tall as me, I'm starting to buy digital versions these days, and so I back the two digital versions. So that's
No, I totally get that. I do that a lot myself because I've just run out of shelf space. So, yeah, digital is great. Digital is also great if you're outside of the United States, because I know shipping is a bear.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we have four different digital packages. We have your basic one that includes issues one and two. And then the next digital package has all of the comics. It has the volume one, volume two, plus the first two issues of Mystery at Pike's Peak. The second one includes the prose, the prequel, novel, and anthology. And the premium digital package not only has all of that, but has the digital download of our 8-episode audio drama with commentary and no commercials.
Which one is that? How much is that one?
I think that's $63.
$62? Okay, I might have to up to that one. Yeah, there it is. Premium digital package. I might have to up to that one. Because that's got stuff in there I probably want to make sure I have. So it sounds good stuff. I guess this is why I was thinking of why calling it a franchise, is because you not only do comics, but you did the audio drama. Haven't you done a novel or two as well?
Yeah, Storm of Secrets is the prequel novel, and Prelude is a prequel anthology of short stories and novellas.
Wow, so this is why I think franchise is a good word to describe all you're doing, because you do so many different good things. I know a lot of people who would love to get comics done, but here you are just rushing past everybody when it comes to novels and audio dramas and all kinds of good things. So, wow, I think that's wonderful that you've had so much success.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
It's really good stuff. So, why don't we talk a little bit about this one here. Let me read the description of this before we get it says Kickstarter. Fleeing arrest, the team arrives at Tesla's experimental station to face a dangerous turn in Caitlin's abilities and a murder plot. And so I read someplace where you were talking about the fact that this was a challenge not only for the group but for you to be able to take them out of Boston. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because that's interesting.
Well, for me, I always like a challenge. And I thought it would be interesting to not only take my characters out of their comfort zone, but mine as well. Up until this point, all the stories have taken place on the East Coast, primarily in Boston, with little bits in New York. And we had one issue that was set in Philadelphia. And that's a kind of different culture, and it's a different look, and it's a different feel. And so it's been a lot of fun to come out in the West and show, you know, what it looked like, what was going on, and give the readers a sense that, you know, this is a really big world. And I talk about the great houses that essentially run what I call the great states of America, my alternate history. And for those who don't know, in the Boston metaphysical universe, the great states of America are run, the government is a parliamentary oligarchy, and only, you know, wealthy industrial families are the ones that literally run the country. And so now you get to see different aspects of them and their influence in a broader, you know, broader vision of this world.
Now, it seems to be more science-based.
Oh, well, there is some science in here. Some of it is accurate, and some of it is completely fictional. if I can make it accurate, I can. But if it doesn't serve the story, I have to go where the story goes. Mm-hmm. So I do try to drop in little tidbits of things that are real, and that's always fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, of course, we mentioned was Caitlin's abilities change, and I saw someplace where that's delved into a little bit. Is that spoilers at this point, or do you want to talk about that? I'm curious to move in that direction.
Well, it after what she dealt with in the original first six issues and the shifter and battling with the shifter, it changed her. And so she's really beginning to learn about her abilities. And we did add an additional character. Her name is Alma Bryant. She's a fictional character. Originally, she was an accountant and an amateur inventor and scientist on the side, but she has now joined the team, and she's the one who you get to see demonstrate the scientific method in regards to Caitlin's paranormal abilities. She's the one who keeps track of them and records them, and as we see her abilities grow and change. Because of this initial interaction in the original six-issue miniseries.
Do we know why they're changing? Is there something within Caitlin that's happening? Is she getting older and that's why they're changing? What's going on with that?
Well, it was essentially the battle with the shifter, which was an interdimensional being. Mm. And so, yeah, it was a difficult psychic fight, which I don't want to give away too many things for people who haven't read the original six-issue miniseries. Mm-hmm. But this psychic fight changed her. Mm-hmm. And so now she has to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Very good, very good. Because I'm just curious, too, why you left Boston and you went to Colorado, which is an interesting choice to me. why was that? Are you familiar with Colorado? Was it a little easier to write? Did Tesla actually have a station in Colorado and that's why you went there? Why did you choose that?
Yeah, Tesla's experimental station did exist in Colorado Springs. I kind of alluded to that. If you read the first standalone sequel, Scourge the Mechanical Men, at the end, that's basically where he ends up. And so he basically owes the team, and particularly Granville. And so Granville's calling in a marker. Because Caitlin and Alma are wanted for sedition, and to avoid arrest, they're basically getting the hell out of Dodge.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sort of curious.
And so, no, the experimental station was absolutely real. He was working on wireless technology, amongst other things, while he was there. He wasn't there very long, maybe a year or two. And so that kind of fits in with what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But... I don't want to give away spoilers.
So. No. Only tell us what we need to know. More than that, we can read and find out for ourselves. I'm just sort of curious because, you know, you've got multiple volumes and stories out there. Have you ever considered, like, combining all of them into, like, one, you know, they have these omnibus type things. Have you ever thought about doing that and putting all those stories together that way?
Well, not all of them together. Volume 1 consists of the original six-issue miniseries, and Volume 2 has all of the four standalone sequels in them, plus bonus stories. Mm-hmm. So I refer to those as Volume 1 and Volume 2. Mm-hmm. I think it's easier for people to take this all in smaller bites.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the thing I'm so interested in, and I want to follow up on, you and I talked and you were doing the audio drama.
Yes.
How did that all turn out from your perspective? I mean, I think it's terrific. I think it's just absolutely wonderful the way that it's done. And it augments the comics and the novel and stuff like that. Are you thinking about doing more of those, or did that kind of scratch that itch for you, or what do you think about that?
I would love to do more. I just don't have time to do more. It's extremely time intensive, and my production team, they were awesome. The actors were amazing. But it's a tremendous amount of work. And I'm not even sure anybody has other people have time, you know, to do it. Because I definitely want to get my production team back, but they may be busy with other things. So, yeah, it's really it's a time issue.
Okay. Because I'd like to see more. And of course,
I know.
I'm just sitting here.
I know. I've had people tell me, like, when are you going to the next one? When are you going to the next one? I'm going like, you know, if I can clone myself, maybe.
See, as a consumer, all I have to do is listen to it. As somebody who has sung in the choir and has seen how much it takes, you know, you sit there and you perform a piece which runs about 3-4 minutes in a performance or something like that. You don't realize all the hours and hours and hours you have to do to get that piece ready to perform. And I'm sure that's times 10 to get all this done, because you had to put the whole, you had to write the script, you had to pick up to get the people and go through rehearsals and then do that and then get figure out the whole thing of how to get it out there and stuff like that. So that was, you know, the next one may not be quite as hard, but it's still... Now you know.
Yeah, I mean,
you know what you got to do now.
You're right. Won't be quite as time intensive because, the actors, if they're available, I think I'd be happy to come on board again. But it's just.
Well, it was great. Let me just tell you that it was great fun.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that, and I know. Everybody just did a tremendous job, so I couldn't be happier. But yeah, it's more work than I had anticipated.
Okay, well, when you're ready, we'll be ready. So that's the best way we can do it. It's better to wait. I always tell people, you know, they always said the comics are a monthly or a usual habitual medium that you have to go every month and pick up a new comic. And if you don't do that, people kind of fall out of the habit of it. But the truth of the matter is, as I always looked at it, is if it's better to wait for the quality than the quantity. So I'd rather do that.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that, particularly... You know, if you're used to getting comics from Marvel or DC, because they have that supply chain, they can do that. Mm-hmm. I think most folks who like comics and graphic novels, particularly the indies, understand how long it takes. Mm-hmm. And I also don't like to inundate my fan base. So when I run a Kickstarter, one, I like to have most of the project already done. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, I feel better about that because mm-hmm. we're just farther along in the process. And it's an event, mm-hmm. you know, we're only running a Kickstarter once or twice a year, it's a thing, mm-hmm. you know, we're back. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of fun when I was starting announcing that, oh, we're going to be running another Kickstarter soon. And then people were posting like, you know, Boss Metaphysical is back, mm-hmm. you know, and so that's pretty exciting. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to add something special to this. And like the variant covers, we're also doing metal covers mm-hmm. for the first time, mm-hmm. Very limited amount. There's only 25 of each and they're almost sold out.
Wow. How about that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's very exciting.
That's great. Now, of course, the one thing we talked about before, and I think we can always talk about again, is the pins. You got into the pins last time very successfully, and apparently you got a Tesla coil lapel pin this time.
Correct.
Talk about that. Is this the same creator who's made them in the past?
Alejandro Lee designed it, and he's designed my last few pins. I'd have to go back, but yeah, he's designed like the last 3 or 4 pins, done a wonderful job. So whenever I know a Kickstarter like 6 months ahead of time, I'm like, hey, Alejandro, what's your schedule like? You know, when can you fit me in? And we chat and talk about ideas and then it all works out. But yeah, I bring him on to do, he just does such a marvelous job, and he does the magnets as well. Which are one of the stretch goals, which we've already made, because we've already made 3 stretch goals. Mm-hmm. So if you get on right now, not only do you get an additional 12 comics, mm-hmm. Digital comics, but the magnets, if you have pledged to a physical reward, and then we're moving up to the metal bookmark, which is has the image of Tesla's experimental station etched in it, into it. It's really cool. We did a metal bookmark for volume 2, and they were just so cool.
So how much do you have to make for that to be unlocked?
For the stainless steel version, 21,000.
Okay, well, as we're recording this, you're not far from that. So my hope is that...
Yeah, we're not terribly far. We'll probably, I'm guesstimating that we should be there probably by the end of the week.
Okay.
If not sooner, I hope.
That'll be great because all these, you come up with such great and unique awards. I think that, that really helps and keeps the enthusiasm going with stuff like that. I was going to talk about the stretch goals, but you beat me to it. So that was good.
Yeah, it's fun because I kind of inadvertently started with the pins and now with the bookmarks. We have collectibles. So... you get like real collectibles, and even if you don't use a bookmark as a bookmark, they're just cool.
When I read like a physical book, I often want to have a piece of paper or something near me, because what happens if I get interrupted and I have to somehow remember where it was I ended reading? And then I always like to have something like a bookmark or something around just to make sure I can do it, because I'm terrible at that. When I get interrupted, I can't ever remember where I was.
Oh yeah, no, I can't either.
So that helps me so much. So I really like that. So it's just great stuff that you come up with. There are other. You have what you call the ultimate package, which
yes.
Tempted me like crazy. But unfortunately, I'm not. My bank isn't an ultimate bank account, so I can't really do that. But I'm sure there's. Let's see. Does it show how many you've gotten so far? You've got 9 so far as we're talking. Hopefully, by the time this post, there'll be many more beyond that too. Because man, you've got that ultimate package has just about everything in the world in there. MP3 downloads of the Ghost Ship.
It has the CD, mm-hmm. of course, physical copies of Volume 1, 2, and Mystery at Pike's Peak. And you also get both variant covers, not the metal version, but regular version. Mm-hmm. Softback copies of Prelude, Storm of Secrets. You get the whole set of lapel pins. You get PDFs. The MP3 download of the Ghost Ship, and also some additional short stories that they're not on Amazon. They were published in anthologies, but they are Boston Metaphysical stories.
I highly recommend that. It really has some wonderful stuff in there and great, great storytelling. Which is, I think, one of the reasons why you fly through all the stretch goals and everything, because it's such great stuff. Even like the pins and stuff you were mentioning, you were talking about them, and I just think that they are, you know, better than the average pin, let's just say. And I think that you do such a good job of making this thing really work and making it, you know, better than like that phrase, better than the average, just the other. It really sparkles when it comes to storytelling. And not only is that really great, but the books themselves are really great, put together well. And I think everything just, you know, you don't do anything half-baked. Everything is really, you know, better than let's just say, some other indie people might produce. And I always think that's a great accomplishment.
You know, it has my name on it, so it has to look beautiful.
Okay, that makes sense. That's very good. I really like that. That's a good way to look at it and stuff. So you've got the issues 1 and 2 is going to be in here, and this will conclude on March 31st. Any idea when 3 and 4 are going to come? Is that going to take a little while?
Well, my hope, and cross my fingers here, is Elizabeth will be done with the art for issue 2 by the end of April, early May. And fortunately, our colorist is, she's working on the pages simultaneously as they come in. So there won't be much of a wait for coloring. And then they'll need to be lettered. And then hopefully, well, when she's done, she immediately starts on issue 3. My initial plan was to run another Kickstarter in the fall, like in October, mid-October to mid-November, for issues 3 and 4. If I feel that not enough is done to warrant running a Kickstarter, then I'll probably push it off to early next year.
Okay, well, considering how well you're doing as we're talking, is it possible you might get enough money out of this Kickstarter to cover not only one and two, but three and four?
Oh, that's hard to say. Okay. I don't know. I won't know till...
Until it's over.
Till it's over. Yeah, because, you know, a lot happens in that last week. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of shifting and moving and everything. So I have to wait and see.
Well, I hope so. I hope that happens. I hope that you get to the place where you don't necessarily need to run anymore because...
That would be lovely.
Because the crowdfunding, and people don't understand this many times, is that it takes a lot to get a crowdfunding thing successful. And a lot of it, this is where the bad part comes in, is you as the creator are the one that doesn't get paid very much, if at all. Which
Correct.
Is the sad part. I mean, you want to be sure to be the artists are paid and everybody else is paid, and that's always a great thing, but you invest all your time and your effort, and you get very little except for the satisfaction of seeing your project come to light, which is always a great thing. But the bad news is that, you know, you're making sure everybody else is in the place that they need to be. But I always wish that the writer and the creators and people like that would take more out, and not just as important as the artists and other people are. People like you deserve some support, I think, and I'd see more of that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. but yeah, it's it all falls under it depends.
Well, because
it's like if it depends on if, like, do I need more storage space? Then you know, money has to go into that for storage space,
right.
And so yeah, it's
because you're in fulfillment too. I mean, you have to bag and board and mail and postage and all, and take them to the post office and get them off to people and stuff like that. And even with the digital ones, you've got to make sure that you know, get all the emails in there in the proper places and make sure everybody gets all the proper stuff. And that all people don't realize that takes a lot of time. And
fortunately, we have things like Backer Kit, which does that for you. Mm-hmm. And so you can, it organizes everything very, very nicely. Mm-hmm. for the digital stuff. But yes, you do have to spend time uploading everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there's any glitches in the upload, obviously you have to go back and re-upload and take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that does happen.
I've helped with the Kickstarter or two in my day, and I've seen how much time that takes, and you know, the driving to the post office, waiting in line there, and all that time that you could be spent creating, you're spending fulfilling, and that's why I always wish that there are more efficient ways to do these kinds of things, but.
There actually is. I don't stand in line at the post office anymore.
Oh.
I actually use Pirate Ship.
Oh.
And print out all the labels here. I can arrange pickup from the post office, so they bring a truck here.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, that's great.
And I know most of us do that now.
Oh, good.
And most of us use Pirate Ship. But, yeah, I used to stand in line. Before there was things like Pirate Ship, which is a third-party postage vendor that I use and has been, they've actually been great. So, and I save money, and the backers save money, so it's a win-win for everybody. So, no, a lot of these processes have been streamlined.
Okay.
So it just depends on whether or not you choose to use them.
I guess that dates me some. It's been a while since I've done those Kickstarters, and I'm not up with all the changes. But, well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that, because the more time you have to create, the better that is for us as fans and as consumers of the stuff that you make. So I'm happy to hear that those kinds of things are making it a little easier on you. It still doesn't take care of everything. You still got to arrange and do all the stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
But,
there's still a lot of other stuff to do, And you have to keep up on the changes as well.
Mm-hmm. This is really great.
So, absolutely.
Well, you're doing a wonderful job, I have to say. This is such a wonderful project and such a great thing that you're doing. I love to see female creators succeed. I love to see female characters shine in science fiction and in comics and things like that. It's such a great time for that right now. I think that these things are just, it's only going to get better and better as time goes along. And I think I talked with you before, but this all just screams movie to me. And I still think that somebody ought to be, that you should have people knocking at your door saying, hey, you want to make a movie out of this? I really think so.
I've had people express interest, but for me, I have to find the right partner, and I'm in no rush.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's the way to be. Patience is a virtue, and especially when it comes to Hollywood and movie making and even TV making. I always talk to creators who have been optioned, and they always, when things actually start to percolate, they always complain bitterly that the things are changed, and they're changed in ways that they don't necessarily like. They're not true to their original concept. And so the bad news is you get paid, and then they come and say, well, hey, we want to make all your characters male. And you're sitting there going like, well, I don't think that's good. Well, too bad we paid for it. And
well, that also depends on what your contract says.
Okay. You sound like you're a smart person.
I actually come from the film and TV industry. So I have had things optioned, and I've had scripts go up the ranks to, the president of a production company to ultimately say, like, no, we're changing our direction. I know how that feels. And I've worked with producers that wanted things changed, and I changed them and, ended up going back to what it originally was because the changes just didn't feel organic. So, I know exactly what you're talking about. But that's when you need to make sure you get a good lawyer on your side. And you retain some sort of control in your contract.
Super. I mean, I so many people have not been aware of those kinds of things. And so I'm glad that you are, because that makes sure that if that ever happens, it'll be true to the stories that you came up with, which I think is very important at this point. Now, I'm sort of curious. You said 3 and 4 is going to be the end of the Mystery at Pike's Peak.
That's cool.
And if this goes really well and you enjoy writing about them in Colorado, might you consider sending them to other places in your universe instead of going right back to Boston?
Who said they were going back to Boston?
Well, this is called the Boston Metaphysical Society. So I kind of assumed that at some point they're going to end up back in Boston. Is that?
Eventually, yes, that's probably true, but... Well, once again, I don't want to give away spoilers, right. But things keep changing for them, and their world keeps expanding. So I don't want to give away what's going to happen at the end. I mean, this is all written, so I know exactly what's going to happen.
Well, it sounds like fun, because you have done something that not many comics creators do, and that's world build. I get so mad at Marvel so much of the time, because everything's in New York. I mean, New York City should have been destroyed 5 times and rebuilt 5 times by the time these books come out. But you have you've developed this whole unique universe that I think is, I'd much rather explore that than see what corner of New York City they're on. So I'm fascinated to see if you go other places, where you would go and what that would look like. Because I think those are that's fun for me. I love to explore, and so I based on what you're doing, I love to see more of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's some critical things that I'm changing in U.S. history, just because I asked myself, what if, and. Some of the bonus material that will be in the various issues will touch on that. Mm-hmm. Talking about like Tesla's experimental station and other issues that were going on during the day, during that time period, and what actually happened and what I've changed. So people understand that, okay, there's what actually happened, and then there's the Boston Metaphysical Universe, which is totally fictional.
I think sometimes people, it reminds me very much of what's the movie that people used to go and they hated to get out of the theater. Avatar. And then people always told me they didn't want to leave the theater. They wanted to stay in the Avatar universe because they liked it so much.
Because it's so beautiful. Yeah, absolutely.
That's what people, I had a boss who told me when he left the theater, he came out into this dull gray world and he was very disappointed. And I said,
yeah, unfortunately, some people have, taken it a little too much to heart, and you know, it hasn't ended well. That's quite true. Some people have suffered from depression after seeing Avatar, because I wanted to go back in that world.
I wanted to stay in there, but I wasn't a big fan of that movie, frankly, because I'd seen that story before. Going Native to me wasn't all that interesting, but
It was fun. It was fun, mm-hmm. It was okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm okay with it, but by the end of it, I was kind of like, yeah, I've been here, I've done this before, but I haven't seen the second one as a result of that, because I kind of said I'm afraid they'll do something else I've seen before, so I don't want to do that.
Yeah, we saw the second one because I wanted to see what they were going to do, and I don't want to ruin it for those. I'm sure most people have seen it by now, but yeah, it was beautiful to watch.
Okay. Yeah,
I'll put that, it was beautiful to watch.
See, I'm a story guy though. You can make the most beautiful movie in the world, but if it's a story I've seen or read before, I'm less than enthusiastic about that. So that's why I like your stories. Your stories are very new and different to me. And so I always enjoy when I get to go someplace I haven't been before. And that's what I enjoy about Boston Metaphysical Society. All these new, different people, even the people that are historical and stuff like that, we get to explore them to where I'm getting to know them better. And I find that always a fascinating thing. So I love the way you tell the stories and create the people and do things. So it's just so much fun for me.
Well, I'm very glad you enjoy it. I really appreciate that.
Because, again, this is why I want movies, because I want to see these people, you know, even the audiobooks, as fun as it is, I would much rather see it on the screen. But, that time will come, I'm sure. If the stories are really good and you have connections in Hollywood, good things can possibly happen. So I'm hopeful that someday we'll get to that place. That would be a great thing to see.
Yeah, it would be. It would be, absolutely.
Now, of course, knowing how far you work in advance, have you already begun laying out what's going to happen next for the Boston Metaphysical Society?
I'm actually going to go back and hopefully finish a trilogy of novels that I started a while ago. The first novel is done. It's takes place roughly 35 years prior to the original graphic novel, and it's during what I call the House Wars, which is the Boston Metaphysical equivalent of the American Civil War.
Oh, okay, great. I'm curious because I like audio novels even these days. Have you ever done your novel, or do you consider doing those novels as audio novels as well?
Audiobooks are very expensive to produce, and I've only produced, I have one short story called Here Abide Monsters, which is an audiobook, and you can pick it up on Amazon and a bunch of other places, I think Spotify and others. But it's a Boston Metaphysical short story, and I did it because I wanted the experience of doing something like that, but having it, it's very small, and so it didn't cost me a lot of money to do. And I did it through Find a Way Voices, which is a production company, and they have actors on board, and you know, casting call went out, and you know, I eventually selected one gentleman to do the reading, and turns out he's a writer as well, and he came and introduced himself to me at a con, I think up at Rose City in Portland one time. He says, "Oh, you remember me? I did the voice for your story." I'm like, "Oh my God." So yeah, I wanted the experience of doing that, and that was great. But yeah, the cost is very prohibitive for independent, and I don't particularly want to use an AI voice.
Oh no.
Which now I'm going to have the option of doing pretty soon. I could probably have an AI voice read it, but to me, you know, there's something about the nuances of an actual actor doing the voice. And if you've ever, are you familiar with Murderbot Diaries by Martha Wells? It's a science fiction series. It begins with novellas, and then she moved into novels. It is fantastic. Mm. And I started listening to it before I actually read it. And the gentleman who does the audiobook, his name is Kevin R. Free, is fantastic. They're hysterical, by the way. They're very, very funny and just terrific. They've won everything. They've won Hugo, Nebula, Locus. I mean, any award out there, they've won it. So... I wouldn't be surprised if they're working on something on Netflix for the animated version of the Murderbot Diaries, which we would be on board with like immediately.
Now, of course, I had to look at Audible, which is where I have my thing, and they do have The Ghost Ship on Audible, but they don't have the other short story you're talking about.
They do.
They do? Okay.
Yeah, it's called Here Abide Monsters.
Okay, hold on. Let me get my little Here Abide.
It should be there.
Abide. Sure enough, let me sign up for that one. I'm going to make sure I can buy with the credit, and I have credits. So I just bought it. So, all right, that's going to be great. I get to that. See, this is why I think franchise is a good word for this. Your stuff is easily accessible and always enjoyable. So I just can't wait to see that. So rather than try to get any kind of spoilers out of the future stuff, all I can say is, I am looking forward to the future of the Boston Metaphysical Society, because you always do a great job of storytelling and character building and even world building. So I can't wait. I'm so glad that your Kickstarter is already a success and going to be even more successful by the time we get to March 31st, a Friday at 2:10 Eastern Time. And if you haven't already backed it, be sure to get out there and back it, because there's plenty of good stuff that I'm sure that Madeline is ready to share with us, and we need to see them. So be sure to back it, and Madeline, keep up the wonderful stuff. I just have to say it's great storytelling that you're doing, and I want to talk with you in the future about future stuff, because I'm sure there's going to be wonderful things to explore in the future with you.
Well, most definitely. And thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.
End results aside, we are not happy. You hacked Justice League systems, disobeyed direct orders, and endangered lives. You will not be doing this again.
I am sorry, but we will.